The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Jane Mosbacher Morris. Jane is the founder and CEO of To The Market, which connects businesses and consumers to ethically made products from around the world. She previously served as the Director of Humanitarian Action for the McCain Institute for International Leadership, where she managed the Institute's anti-human trafficking program, and currently serves on the Institute's Human Trafficking Advisory Council. Earlier, she worked in the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Counterterrorism and the Secretary's Office of Global Women's Issues. She has a new book. It's called Buy the Change You Want to See. Jane Mosbacher Morris, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think it's always good to start these conversations with either a central idea or a story. And you have a story from your trip to India when you were working for the McCain Institute, and that basically led to the central idea of your book, right? Can you tell us about that trip and where it led you?
Sure. So I joined the McCain Institute to focus on human trafficking and labor exploitation. And very early on at my time there, I was asked to go to India to learn more about human trafficking and labor exploitation, and actually to escort Mrs. Cindy McCain, mm-hmm. Senator McCain's wife. And on the trip, we visited red light districts to understand what that dynamic looked like. We visited aftercare facilities, which is a place where survivors of trafficking and other forms of abuse are able to heal. But ultimately, at the end of the trip, we visited these two pro-social businesses that were employing human trafficking survivors to actually produce products. And I was so struck here in the heart of Calcutta, right outside these red light districts, that there were these two bastions of hope and joy and dignity that were literally employing these human trafficking survivors to produce products that I thought were really incredible. And it really was the beginning of me moving into the retail sector.
Yeah, what an interesting... So... And I think it's smart and it's cool that you know, using the power of business, of the money you spend and the money you earn as a way to make change. You write in the book, quote, "Without earning power, others can silence you." And that was so provocative to me. And I was reflecting on a past podcast with an academic who wrote a book on dignity. And she studies that. And she says people conflate dignity and respect. Respect is a thing you can earn, but everyone is born with dignity. But when you strip away dignity, I mean, that is at the core of the worst of the worst of humanity.
Mm-hmm. No, that's such a good point. And I totally believe her point as well, that everybody is born with dignity. I think everybody has the inherent desire to contribute. And sometimes that contribution is to our immediate family. Sometimes it's a bigger desire to contribute to the larger community, our country, the world. But when people are not given the opportunity to have basic controls over their life, then they are stripped, I think, of the basic sort of human right of dignity.
Yeah. And I think everyone sort of easily gets the idea of how you can put these people to work to regain their dignity. I think what is more nuanced, which is really the bulk of the book, is how can I, as an individual who is spending my hard-earned money, help these people? And that's what your company does.
Yeah, so To The Market focuses on connecting non-traditional suppliers which can include sort of post-trauma communities like human trafficking survivors, all the way from cooperatives like that to simply women-owned and operated businesses, factories that are operating in communities that have traditionally overlooked them, discounted them, etc. And what my work at the market in building this business has taught me is that we have, as individuals and as people working within businesses or nonprofits, some larger sort of professional organization, have so much more power than we realize to make a difference both for other people and or for the planet by thinking about who we spend our money with and how that money is spent. And it doesn't always have to be this idea of, I want to support a cooperative in India that's producing bags. You know, that might work for one person, but another person might feel really strongly about supporting the mom and pop grocery in their neighborhood, or buying made in the USA apparel, or some other value set that's important to them. And that's the thesis of the book, that we can align our purchasing decisions with our values.
I found a weird connection to Second City and what you do. So I've worked in the theater industry in Chicago my whole life, and Second City is a for-profit business, which is very rare in Chicago theater. All the big theaters, the Goodman Theater, Chicago Shakespeare, they're all not-for-profit. And part of the reason, one of the things I like about us being for-profit is I feel like the for-profit tension allows us to innovate more quickly. We're not beholden to boards of directors and other sort of constraints that might exist. So you do this sort of social good in an industry that is probably mostly non-for-profit, right? But you made the choice to be for-profit.
I did. And, you know, what's interesting is that some of our suppliers are for-profit, some are not-for-profit, but almost all of our clients, meaning the people we're producing products for, are unquestionably for-profit. And so we're able to leverage these big for-profit dollars, these procurement budgets, to have a huge impact on the lives of other people, far more, I think, from a scale of influence, than if I was in a position where I was trying to apply for grants to run some sort of capacity building program in a different community.
Yeah. And that you didn't know that going in that you would end up being for profit, right?
Well, I didn't know if I didn't even think I would start a business. I mean, I was totally happy being in a position where I was working for someone else and trying to think through what my personal contribution would be to creating change on the ground through the dignity of work. And it was quite a journey for me to get to a place where I decided that the way that I could have the most significant impact was actually starting not only a for-profit business, but one that was a venture-backed for-profit business that I fundamentally believed could scale as big as any other venture-backed business.
Right. So let's talk a bit of why we are in the place we are today, why this is so important. And you write in the book, quote, businesses are facing what I've come to call a trifecta of pressure and interest that didn't exist as recently as 10 years ago. So talk to us about the environment we live in now that makes this so necessary.
Well, I'm delighted about this trifecta of pressure, but it's the pressure is real. Mm-hmm. And the expectations that people, especially this coming generation of millennials and Gen Z, have for businesses, their expectations are higher than ever. They fundamentally believe as generations that businesses should have a purpose that is beyond just generating profits for shareholders, employees, owners, etc. They fundamentally believe that if I am going to, as an individual, engage with you as a business and you get to exist within my community, that you need to be positively contributing to other people and to the planet for me to want to continue to do business with you, to service you, to spend my money with you. And so what's so interesting is that companies are now doing more than ever to articulate what their social good is. And sometimes that manifests in a corporate social responsibility report. Sometimes that manifests Pacts and commitments to sustainable development goals, which are these United Nations goals that have been set for people to sort of collectively rally around on how we sort of move the global community forward on all things economic development and societal development. But the activity is more than ever in the business community, and so much so that I actually think the role of the business community in impacting social good is almost at a place where it's outpacing and outstripping the activity, certainly from a capital standpoint, of not-for-profits and the government.
Yeah. This is all part and parcel, I think, of larger conversations that we're having as a nation right now, which I think are good, which are we have taken the status quo for granted when the status quo is really only a couple of decades, or let's even say 50 years old, that, you know, you have a quote in the book, quote, we've lost the connection between what we buy and who made it. And that's a fairly recent phenomenon. That's not something that's so ingrained, but it really is going to take changing the cultural conversation, getting people to not just think it has to be a certain way. All this talk around billionaires and whether they should exist or not, which is so scary to people. And you're looking like, it, you know, it wasn't always like this at all, if you know anything about history. And that's what you're butting up against, I think, with your work.
Yeah, it is. It's a really interesting time. And, you know, globalization has so many amazing outcomes, and some outcomes that have been more controversial.
Yeah.
And some of those controversial outcomes have been around this disparity between many of the people who participate in producing the products that we in the developed world enjoy. Mm-hmm. And that's beyond just, you know, the space I operate in, which is the sort of apparel, accessories, home goods industry. But that's the food that we eat, the coffee we drink. We as a developed community tend to be the consumers of products that tend to be made, produced, grown in the less developed parts of the world. And as globalization continues to increase and we have more connectivity and transparency to these communities that once seemed very far away, it's now becoming harder and harder for us to turn a blind eye to potential exploitation that's taking place in a supply chain of a product we maybe once enjoyed blissfully.
All right, so let's go there. I am talking to you, and my hand keeps reaching for my iced venti Americano from Starbucks. You and I share a passion for coffee. And I have to say, I was actually really surprised to read in your book that coffee is one of the most transparent supply chains of any commodity in the world. Why would I have thought the opposite? I just assumed that it was really dirty and not transparent.
Well, because it was dirty at some point. I mean, like so many commodities, it used to be a particularly opaque industry, which is not unlike other industries that still operate that way. I would argue that the fashion industry still is pretty opaque, where there's just a huge disconnect between the makers and the ultimate buyers.
Mm-hmm.
But what's so interesting about coffee is that Starbucks, which we talk about quite a bit in the book, did such a beautiful job of helping to educate the sort of mass public in the United States in particular about coffee, to the extent that we as a nation got more and more interested in the varietals mm-hmm. of coffee. Whereas we might have, you know, been totally satisfied 10 years ago with just drinking Folgers or, you know, the equivalent of like a, you know, just sort of an inexpensive coffee that is sort of mass produced. The proliferation of Starbucks has really created a mass demand for what's described as sort of, quote, gourmet coffee,
mm-hmm.
where there's a premium placed on how the coffee is grown. It could be fair trade certified from a labor standpoint. It could be shade grown, which is a sort of technique where it's not grown in a clear-cut field, but it's grown under the shade of taller trees. There are all these sort of environmental and social elements that have been incorporated into, quote, gourmet coffee that we as consumers are now willing to pay more for because we fundamentally believe it tastes better. And most of the time it does because the product is better. And because of that, that transparency, that storytelling, that demand for those third-party indicators like the Fair Trade certification have given the industry much more transparency than existed even a decade ago.
Yeah, that is, we had on the podcast a couple of co-authors with Clayton Christensen of his latest book, talking about nations that aren't prosperous and why, and their theories are just what you're talking about, which is it's less about going and trying to get something cheaper, and it's more about finding markets that aren't being served and give them something that they didn't even know that they wanted. And this is a perfect example with coffee, because it's, you know, America was always like, I think you have in the book something like 600 billion cups of coffee are consumed, you know, a year across the world. And you wouldn't think that inside that market, there would be a place for, oh, you want to buy a more expensive, you know, version of the drink you're already drinking. But that, there you go. It was there. There was a need and a want for that. And that could then also produce, you know, sort of wonderful opportunities for people in poorer communities to actually have dignified work, producing a really, really fine product.
Yes, I think when we are able to create a dynamic where a consumer is willing to pay a premium for a better product, and that better product means that workers were more fairly compensated and the production process was more environmentally friendly, then you're just in a, you know, I think a really beautiful win-win situation, because it's positive for everyone at every part of the value chain.
You mentioned the fashion industry. So this was a stat that surprised me at first, but not after I thought about it, where you say the clothing industry is the second largest polluter in the world, second only to oil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fashion industry is so fun. I work on it and work in it. Mm-hmm. But it's also plagued with, you know, some really challenging dynamics in the supply chain, where as manufacturing moved away from the United States to other countries, the labor and environmental footprint that was made as we as Americans got used to less expensive clothing and more clothing. So our desire to not only have less expensive goods, but to have more and more goods, period, total, like, number of goods, has really put so much pressure on the supply chain that it is an industry that has serious risk for labor exploitation and has, you know, this not so great history from an environmental standpoint, whether that be around water or emissions or you know, maybe most problematically, the amount of waste that's created and the amount of landfill tonnage that's created because of the fashion industry. And I love fashion. I'm not one that is one that would advocate that the entire industry, you know, needs to get blown up. But I do think that we as a consumer have an opportunity to reward brands and retailers who are investing in better supply chain practices by what we describe as a boycott. So the opposite of a boycott. Hmm. So a boycott meaning I choose to support these brands, even though it might cost me a little bit more to have that organic cotton or to have that fair trade certification or to see the programs that this brand is running. I want to be a part of that because nobody should have to die for me to have a cute shirt.
Right, right. And the amount of clothes that we throw away, I mean, like, people in past centuries would be aghast at our personal waste of this stuff.
It's so bizarre to think about how many pieces of clothing we as Americans buy now versus what we would have bought even 100 years ago. I mean, truly, you think about, and we talk about this in the book, how, you know, I was born in a city here in the United States. I'm from Houston. And if I had been born in 1885 instead of 1985, then I likely would have had probably three pairs of clothes.
Right.
Pajamas, Sunday clothes and work clothes. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
Yep. Yep.
And now it's like I could buy three dresses, you know, now, and Amazon will deliver it, you know, in 10 minutes. So it's quite interesting that we have gotten, as I talk in the book, so figuratively and literally away from the makers of our products.
Mm-hmm. I want you to talk a little bit about visiting that denim factory in Nicaragua, speaking of fashion, because I was telling my daughter about this, and I'm like, do you want to know how they distressed jeans? And she's like, I do want to know. So talk to us about what you discovered on that trip, because I thought it was really interesting.
It was really interesting, and it was really fun. So I serve on VF Corporation's advisory board for responsible sourcing. Mm-hmm. And VF Corporation owns a number of iconic American brands, things like North Face, Vans, Timberland. And in my work as being an advisor on responsible sourcing, I had this opportunity to visit a number of their factories, one of which was producing jeans for Wrangler and Lee. Mm-hmm. And besides learning that I am apparently a horrible seamstress and should, you know, avoid sewing machines, especially industrial sewing machines at all costs, mm-hmm. I also learned just how many hands go into the creation of making jeans, and not only in the construction of a basic wash, but when you have sort of embellished or certain sort of faded jeans where the wash is particularly unique, there are individuals that are like physically sanding your jeans to get that look. And, you know, of course, I thought it must have been computer generated. So when I saw people physically sanding the jeans,
yeah,
I thought, gosh, I really have not appreciated even what you would think a jean would be, like a basic garment to produce versus a complicated dress or jacket. But it turns out that they're pretty labor intensive.
Yeah. And there was another aspect, and this involved your trip to Haiti, and it's other places in the book as well. There's a Matisse quote that you have, which is, quote, much of the beauty that arises in art comes from the struggle an artist wages with his limited medium. And that stuck out to me because there's this great story about the jazz pianist Keith Jarrett, where, I don't know if you've ever heard this, but he showed up at a German concert hall, and it was a solo piano concert, and the piano was horribly broken. Only one of the pedals worked. Only the middle of the piano worked. Everything else was broken on the sides. And he was like, I can't do this. And this teenage girl was like, the concert is sold out. You know, I tried to get another piano. I couldn't do it. And he's like, he had an idea. He's like, okay, I'm going to do it, but you need to professionally record this, and I'm going to send this out to everyone to show what happens when, you know, I don't get the instrument I need. That concert is called the Cold Concert and is the best-selling jazz recording, solo piano recording of all time. So,
wow.
So what he needed to do was use the middle of the piano, which is very melodic. He had to just hammer on the pedal, and he's known for these sort of like groans and other stuff. So that comes through, and it's an amazing performance. And that is exactly what you're talking about. It's you have these incredible limitations, which actually potentially open you up to creating really significant art.
Yeah, the people in Haiti, and of course, Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, mm-hmm. and yet it is perhaps the most creative country in the Western Hemisphere that I have at least visited. And I attribute so much to the creativity to the fact that their resources are so limited. And so they have turned to oftentimes materials, surfaces that you and I would look at and think, trash. To them, they think this could be made into something purposeful or beautiful. And I've seen it firsthand with the way that they make everything from incredible paper mache, from, you know, discarded paper, newspapers, mm-hmm. to incredible upcycled oil drum art and jewelry, to taking discarded cow horn and making beautiful home goods. I mean, the list really goes on. And I so attribute that partly to the fact that they have so few resources that they have been disciplined about using what they do have at their disposal.
We're going to ask you for a yes and story shortly, but I do want to talk to you about garbage because that's a big part of the book.
Talking trash.
We're going to talk some trash, but not in the way that most people mean that. Three companies basically control trash. That's true.
Yeah, it is.
That's not good.
The waste and recycling industry is so fascinating, and I've gotten to know it because my husband, Nate, founded a green waste and recycling company. Mm. So he's had to learn about the waste and recycling industries. And the history of waste actually is totally fascinating because even during the Roman times, the Caesars, the leaders, would literally use waste contracts as like levies of power.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole like mob concept of like the mob and, you know, these sort of not so great influences being a part of the waste industry literally go back to the Roman times.
Mm-hmm.
But in the United States, there are essentially three companies that dominate the industry. And because of that, there hasn't been nearly as much competition and transparency as there should be. And so I'm excited to see that there are new companies that are trying to unseat these incumbents, enforcing not only greener solutions, but a lot more sort of technology to reduce everything from, you know, the number of haulers that are on the road to the amount of waste that ends up in the landfill.
Right. Well, and that's it, right? So this contributes to the cycle of poverty that exists because these landfills are built next to poor communities because they're the ones who don't have the political power to, you know, kick them out. And there's toxicity from there. And it's like it's like in Flint, right? You know, like fix the water. Like what is going on? But, you know, this and you talk about this book, this trying to bring agency to individuals and how do we as consumers help them? And we can by what we choose to buy and who we choose to work with. So don't work with those three companies.
Yeah, I would have to agree. Yeah. I mean, yeah, leverage that purchasing power. And oftentimes you as an individual have the ability to switch your waste provider.
Yeah.
And we've sort of been led to think that it's like, this is the only, you know, this is the only power company that serves my neighborhood, so yep. I have to go with them, or, you know, that it's the same with waste and recycling. But that's not true. Most of the time, you legally have options. You just have to ask. So I encourage people to ask your building where you work, ask the building where you live, or your neighborhood, who is servicing our waste and recycling, and when was the last time we bid that out to give maybe greener companies the opportunity to win our business.
100%. Okay, we end every podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, you're making something out of nothing with another person or a group. You can't get anywhere by saying no, and you can't really get much farther by just saying yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
You know, I actually think writing the book, Buy the Change You Want to See, was literally my yes and.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm such a planner. I'm super, super sort of organized with having like a 5-year, a 10-year plan. And I usually achieve most of the things on my list. But writing a book was never on any of my lists.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like on the bucket list. It wasn't on like 5, 10, whatever it was. And when I started to the market my business, a literary agent came to me and said, have you ever thought of writing a book? And that was really my yes and, because normally if it wasn't on that like 5-year, 10-year list, I'd be like, nope, and it's not on the plan, so it's not happening. But me saying yes and was such a great lesson for me, because the lesson was that you are sometimes presented opportunities that you cannot foresee.
Mm-hmm.
And being open to taking them can lead to outcomes that are more exciting, more fulfilling, help advance other things that might be on that 5-10 year list than you could ever imagine. And I certainly find myself in that position now, where now being a published author, I never thought I would be an author, but yet here I am. And I'm so glad I said yes and to that literary agent.
Yeah, that's so true. Because I also stumbled into writing a book. It wasn't the plan. It kind of came to me, do you want to do this? And there was all the reasons for saying no. But one of the byproducts of it were when you are forced to tell your own narrative, your own story, you discover what's really going on in your story, and it's different than the one you've been telling yourself when you're forced to do that. I don't know if you had that in the process of writing the book, that discovery.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, writing a book is like, you know, writing a sort of memoir, even if it's not, you know, about your own personal story. It really focuses. Makes you focus on, you know, what have you learned? What is your opinion? What do you want to put out to the world that will live on forever?
Yeah.
And so getting really clear on what that is, like, what do I stand for? What do I want my great, 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 great grandchildren to potentially read that I, you know, supposedly said is, gosh, it forces some discipline and thinking, that's for sure.
The book is called Buy the Change You Want to See. Jane Mosbacher Morris, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Well, I've been working in a home.